So we're going to continue our look at does God exist? And the approach we've decided to take is pretty broad. We wanted to include any possible approach to that question, some that we are going to really identify with and say, yep, that one does it for me, and then some they're going to look at and say, that one makes no sense to me whatsoever. Please move to the next one as fast as possible. We're going to look at just as many as possible because when it comes to believing in God, people start in different places. And so there may be someone here who hears one of these slides and says, yep, that's the one. I wasn't sure before, but that did it. And someone sitting right next to them says, that made no sense to me at all. But that next one's pretty good. You know. So as many approaches as possible has been my more recent philosophy on how to talk about the existence of God. Last week, we went through what I would call the primary approaches. These are the classic ancient methods of talking about the existence of God. And one that's pretty new, but I think counts as ancient because he's borrowing old stuff. So the first one we looked at was maybe belief in God is a properly basic belief, which would just mean maybe you don't need any evidence. Maybe the existence of God is so obvious to the human creature that you don't have to prove anything, that you can just say, I believe in God. Why don't you? And there have been some notable philosophers, Christian philosophers, who have taken that point of view and defended it and said, I don't have to offer any evidence. To me, it's obvious. How do you know who your parents are? And how do you know that's air you're breathing? And how do you know you're in Glenpool, Oklahoma? We don't test those things. We just look around and say, it looks pretty obvious to me. So I believe in God. And that's their approach. Some people, that's plenty. Some will say, I'm not so sure about that. Another approach was the cosmological argument, which, been big word, but it's a very, very ancient argument. It wasn't called that back in the old times. But basically, is the argument is that everything that begins to exist has a cause. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, so the universe has a cause. We talked about that a little bit, and the neat thing about it, most people don't argue about the first one. Things that begin to exist have a cause. There are a few who believe you really can pull a rabbit out of a hat, that really things just pop into existence. They can go looking for those rabbits if they want. But for the rest of us that are pretty sure if something happens, there's a reason for it happening, and most folks are okay with that idea. You move on to the second point. Did the universe have a beginning? And here we said we're in a unique position in modern society. Ancient people weren't sure the universe had a beginning. Aristotle thought it probably just always been here. But modern science, we disagree on issues of evolution and mechanics and all that kind of stuff, but modern science does agree with the scriptures that the universe began. In fact, emphatically so. That's been the decisive scientific model of the 20th and now the 21st century, known commonly as the Big Bang model, was a rejection of the previous view that the universe had always been here. They said, no, the universe hasn't always been here. It started. And then they started going through the hoops of trying to figure out how to make it start without involving God, which seems to be some people's preoccupation. Well, we don't have to go down and chase that rabbit. We're not interested in that. We just want the basic premise. Do you agree the universe started? Yes. Okay. Everything that has a beginning has a cause, right? The universe has a beginning. The universe has a cause. So let's start talking about that. And that's a good place to talk about God because there aren't a lot of other options. If you say, well, couldn't the cause be fill in the blank? Some force of nature. Well, that's part of the stuff we're trying to figure out how it got here, right? So you have to somehow start with nothing and still have something. And that's the problem for a lot of scientists. Teller was one of the MIT scientists who really worked on this from the mathematical point of view. And he said, I just end up in this loop, and I don't know how to get into it because I've got to have something and I've got to have nothing and I've got to have something. Yeah, because it doesn't work. You're going to have something other than the universe to begin the universe. It's the only way it can work, and people are stubborn about it, but that's just a reality. And then the final one we looked at last week, we called it the teleological, but that, again, just fancy terminology. Teleos is Greek for a mature or perfect thing, a thing with an end in sight, a thing with a purpose in sight. Anywhere in the New Testament you see the word perfect, when that which is perfect has come, that's a form of the word teleos, when something has reached its conclusion. Okay? Does the universe seem like it has a purpose or a function? Or do individual parts of the universe seem like they have function? If so, in our experience, everything that has a design has a designer. Or to say it the way the Bible says it, every house is builded by some man, and he who built all things is God. That's the biblical version of the teleological argument. Okay, every house is builded by some man, and he who built all things is God. And Christians have been saying that for a long time. That when you look at the universe, it kind of seems like it does things. It's not just random bits flying. There's lots of random stuff. But even the random seems to do something. If you look at a picture of the solar system, how does it move? Does Mars just like fly off in wonky circles through the sky and come back around to different places every year? No, it kind of just goes in its little ellipse and it ends up in the same spot, moves around. And when people started making models of the way things move through the sky, they said, well, this is really neat and tidy. The same stuff's there at the same time every year. This is what the winter sky looks like. This is what the summer sky looks like. Things are really nice and organized. What about human anatomy? This was a slow one coming. Remember, science is mostly kind of a new thing. It hasn't been around a long time in the way we think of it. So ancient scientists weren't really sure how the human body works, but they cut up a few of them and they tried to figure it out. And even they noticed it seems like stuff in there has a function. Everything has a job to do. And it's well crafted for that particular function. And the more we've learned about the human body, the more we've noticed, yeah, that's true. Things work really well. There is no one in their right mind who would trade a functional, natural hand for a prosthetic. Right? Now, if you have a birth defect, something like that, you might say I'd trade. But if you have a normal hand, there is no human-crafted prosthetic that does all the tasks with as much ease and simplicity and beauty and functionality as the human hand does. Okay, the ability, the thing you can touch and know if something's smooth or rough, you can gather its temperature. These are all things you can do. When they started building a decade ago, the next generation of really advanced prosthesis, one of the tasks that they wanted to master was to help amputees coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan to be able to pick up a grape. That was one of their thresholds. How ordinary an action is that for you? Well, of course, pick up a grape. What's difficult about that with a prosthetic? To know exactly how much pressure you can put on a grape so that it doesn't slide out of your hand, but so that it doesn't explode in your hand either. And to generate that information instantaneously from the same device picking up the grape. So it has to be able to pick up the grape and transmit somewhere to some mechanism that can say, whoa, that's enough, about to bust the grape, and every grape's different, right? That simple that you do every day was this insurmountable threshold for prosthetics for a long time. They didn't know if they could ever get there. More recently, they've gotten very close. They've gotten where they can pick up things, and there's some neat stuff going on. They do prosthetics down at OSU-IT, right? Yeah, they go down to Okmulgee, they tell you all about it. There's a lot of breakthroughs in that. But my point is, if you see, the first time I saw a video with the next generation of prosthetic hands that could pick up a grape, and they showed all the rigmarole of what was involved in doing it, you knew somebody had worked on it. You knew somebody smarter than you had done it. It was an incredible act of human ingenuity that your hand can do from birth. Calvin picks up stuff and throws it all the time. And he's never been to OSU-IT. How is he able to make his little fingers do that? He can pick up a grape. Threw a grape at me this morning. How does that work? That this is, on its own, better than anything we've crafted, makes us ask, doesn't that mean someone much smarter than us crafted this version of it? And the same could be true for virtually anything. So that's the basic idea of the teleological argument. Tonight, we're going to keep going in that direction. Excuse me. And if you're a science buff, then tonight's the night for you. If you hate science, bear with us. We'll get through it as soon as we can. I used to be in love with this particular method of doing apologetics. That's why I got into science. I wanted to know science and prove things and do apologetics from the science point of view. I have since fallen out of love with it. I still do it, but I'm not as passionate about it as I used to because it's a moving target. You can go back and find scientific apologetics from a century ago, That just seems like a bad joke now, because science has developed so much in a century. And a century from now, the best thing I could ever write about science is going to look 100 years old, right? What does a science textbook look like even from when you were a kid? This is like the second time tonight I've tried to call you old, Bill. I'm sorry. First there was the Hugo McCord joke, and now the textbook. I'm sorry. But even when you were a kid, I mean, how different is the science textbook, which was the best knowledge of its day, versus now? Okay? It's a moving target. If you had showed me the iPhone just 15 years ago, I would have thought it was an alien technology that you had stolen from a spacecraft, right? And I'm carrying one in my pocket. One of the first problems I ever caused for my dad, this is going to sound like a long story, but let me get there. First problems I ever caused for my dad, when my dad was the preacher at the Drumright Church of Christ, he convinced the men that to do a better job of putting the bulletin together and stuff, it would be really nice if they were to purchase a computer. And so the church purchased the state-of-the-art Tandy computer that had, you know, no functionality whatsoever, but it was state-of-the-art. It was the best of the best of its time. And I was, I don't know, 3, and thought it was really neat to bang on the keys, right? And so the men who had approved the purchase of that, of course, don't know anything about computers because nobody did, they just walk by and say, 3-year-old Ben just banging on the keys on this brand new piece of future equipment, science fiction that they had purchased for the preacher to use, and threatened to fire Dad for misusing the equipment because I was tearing it up. Turns out you couldn't tear it up. Tandys were indestructible. But doesn't matter. The point is, that computer could fit like a million times over on my phone, and I can do things on it. It's incredible. Science is a moving target, is my point. So we're going to go through the science, but I just don't want you to fall so headlong in love with it that you say, aha, we've done it. And then tomorrow you read something in a science journal and say, oh, well, they changed their mind on that one. Are eggs good for you or bad for you? I'm really asking, which one is it today? They're good today? Okay. What year is it? Yeah, what year is it? So science is a moving target, just remember that, and then we'll be okay. Okay, scientific approaches. One way to think about this idea of the design in the universe is what's been called the intelligent design movement. And the other phrase you'll hear is irreducible complexity. But let me talk about the first phrase. The intelligent design movement was a movement among scientists to advance an alternative to blind evolutionary forces. And they worded it very carefully because they wanted to get it in schools. They knew if they said God making stuff, that was not going to end up in a textbook. No chance. But what if we say something completely unreligious? Intelligent design. Well, that's vague enough. Maybe they'll let us work that into a textbook. Didn't work out. The movement came to a grinding halt and still is. There's still serious people working on it, but it's not ever going to end up in your kid's textbook in a public school as an alternative to evolution. Because even that much, intelligent, the word intelligent has frightening consequences. See, atoms aren't intelligent. Electrons aren't intelligent. People are intelligent. Some of them are. Gods are intelligent, right? Divine beings. And so for the scientific community, even that is too religious to put in a textbook. That's a scary thought. But the way it got started was guys like Michael Behe, I'm mentioning here, and others doing research in the cutting edge of modern science and saying, we have no evolutionary explanation for what we're seeing. And these are guys, I don't know if it's Behe or the guy at Kenyon, the guy he worked with, Kenyon, was a Nobel laureate, okay, in biology. He's not an adjunct somewhere doing stuff in his basement. Nobel laureate biologist said, we have no evolutionary way to explain the things we see in nature. Here's Behe's statement. He says, what is irreducibly complex? He says, it's an irreducibly complex system cannot be produced directly. That is, by continuously improving the initial function, which continues to work by the same mechanism, by slight successive modification of a precursor system, because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional. In my opinion, that sentence is irreducibly complex, and I don't know why these guys feel like they have to say everything like that, but let me see if I can chop it down just a little bit. what he's trying to say is we see things in nature that are complicated. They're not just complicated. Remember, for blind evolution, naturalistic, godless evolution to work, you have to be able to start with something. We'll make it as small as you want, a cell. And you're supposed to be able to make one change, and then make another change, and then make another change, and make another change. And over the course of successive changes, you can make something more complicated. Okay? That sounds good so far. And we'll just keep changing. And eventually, if that's allowable, if you can do that in nature, and you know, to a degree you can, do we have breeds of dogs that we didn't used to have? Ask Lucas about his Shadorki. Apparently it's a Shih Tzu, Yorkie, Dachshund mix or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, it's a strange little critter. Well, we got critters that we didn't used to. You can do some things, right? You can do things biologically. Great controversy in the world right now is about genetically modified corn or genetically modified. We can do some things, can't we? We can make some change. So the idea was if we could just keep making changes, we could make anything that way, or that is, nature could. Nature could start with a cell and just keep moving and changing and evolving step at a time until it got to a human. Okay, that was the idea in really short language. What Michael Behe is saying is, problem is, we have things that are so complex, we can't reverse engineer it. Anything we change about this, it no longer works. So what was the state of this thing, one change before it got here? It wasn't just a less effective thing. It was something that didn't work at all. If you make one change, it doesn't work at all. But somehow it had to evolve to this state. He says it's not just complex, it's irreducibly complex. You can't make it less complex and have it still work. Okay? So picture's worth a thousand words, especially if those are the words, because that's just a really awful sentence. So let me show you a picture. This is his favorite example. This is, now, you talk to somebody in life science, they're going to do a better job than this than me, but I'll do the best I can. This is a flagellar motor on the back of an E. coli bacteria or something of that sort. Okay, and what is this? Is a cell. So think about that, 27 nanometers. I'm not going to try to tell you how small that is. Small. Okay. This is down at a cellular level. This is a piece of a cell. How do these little bacteria and things move around in the petri dish? Some of them, on the back of them, have a little filament that sticks out. And it sticks out and it bends over at a 90-degree angle. And it rotates at tens of thousands of rotations per second. Okay? Your tachometer is just blowing up. Okay? Tens of thousands of rotations per second. And they propel it through whatever fluid it's floating in. Forward, sideways, backwards. You can angle it, or you can't, it can, angle itself, and it points in a slightly different direction. It can stop instantaneously. E. coli don't run into the side of the petri dish and break their face or anything, right? They can instantaneously stop and back up and reverse. Okay. And this is the mechanism that makes it work. So there's a hook joint that comes out of the cell wall. There's a filament sticking out the end there that's kind of your, we would call it a propeller if it was on your boat. And then down below, you have, well, rotors. You have gears that move around a central turning axis. And Behe and other biologists were looking at this and said, which part evolved last? Which was the last part to evolve? Because if you take away any of the parts, none of it works. It doesn't work poorly. None of it works. What if you take out the rotors so it doesn't spin correctly, but you've got the filament and everything else? Well, what is a big, long filament attached to a boat that doesn't spin? That's called an anchor. This cell isn't going anywhere. In fact, it is less able to survive. Evolution should pluck it out of the gene pool and get rid of it. Well, what if the filament evolved last? What was the other thing doing? Just an opening in the side of the cell that spins and accomplishes nothing? Right? And so what Behe and his fellow guys were saying is this thing couldn't work if you change any element of the structure. So which part evolved last? And that was his question. And it got him into a lot of questions, a lot of trouble, because you're not supposed to ask that question. And he could give you a litany of little devices in nature that are this kind of complex. He says, when you zoom in, he says, now I understand. He says, Darwin didn't have access to this, right? Darwin couldn't tell you about this. Darwin was looking at pigeons and seagulls and turtles and stuff, right? He couldn't look at this. He didn't have microscopes to the level that we do, but we do now. And now we're looking, and it's not the way he thought. It is infinitely more complicated than just breeding something into existence. DNA is another example. The human eye, now the human eye I know a little bit more about because of astronomy. We had to study the eye so we could study optics so we could study telescopes. The human eye is just remarkably complex. There's muscles in there that are right at this moment adjusting not only where you're pointing, but the size and the amount of light that's let into your eye, adjusting focus so that you can look here and then immediately look back there. How long does it take you to change your telescope? Just imagine, you got a telescope up here, and I've got it focused on Edwin's head, and I want to change it now to look at Bill's head. What's involved? I got to turn some cranks, I got to change the focus, I got to do all that. Your eye instantaneously makes that adjustment and goes back and forth without any effort on your part. It does the math. How does anyone put a basketball on a basketball hoop? How is that even possible? They don't know how far it is away. They don't have a measuring tape and go out there and say, well, I'm about 15 feet out. The arc is about this long, and here's the angle. Your brain takes the data from two eyes, does trigonometry that you can't even spell, and does it all instantaneously and estimates it's about that far. If you throw it about this far, it'll go in, or for some of us not. But you'll get the basic idea, right? Your brain and your eye are working together and doing the math on that. Every time you toss someone a piece of paper or throw a basketball or drive your car, hope it's working, right? Your eye is a logarithmic detector. And what that means, again, just a big word we had to learn once. When the room has twice, or let me say it like this. When your eye receives 10 times as much light, your eye detects it as twice as bright. When your eye receives 100 times more light, it detects it as 3 times brighter. Why does that matter? It means that there is a huge range from dark to light that your eye can take in without being blinded or being completely blind because it's too dark. That in a very, very, very dark room, you can get used to it and see pretty well. And then you can go outside with a star burning up in the sky, right, putting off gigawatts of whatever, you know, of all kinds of light. And you can see in that environment, too, most of the time. How is your one telescope able to handle that range of light? It's because it's built. I'm even using the word. It's designed in a way that's made to receive huge ranges of light, huge ranges of color. Think about that. What is color? Color is the difference in frequency in electromagnetic radiation. And your eye can tell the difference on the narrowest band of the spectrum between blue and red. We have to spend millions of dollars to make machines that can do that. Your eye does it every time you pick out a tie. Okay, these are all things your eye does. Which part of that evolved last? Which part of that? And I haven't even got to tear ducts yet. Because none of it works if you can't blink. You know what happens if you can't blink? By the time you're one, you stick that first thing in your crayon in your eye, you don't have any eyes, right? Blinking mechanism is this hugely significant reflex, automated. You can blink if you want to, but you can't stop. Because it does it on its own, whether you want to or not, because it's built in. Tear ducts, right? It moisturizes and lubricates the whole mechanism on a regular basis. Does anyone sit here and think about it? Have you ever thought, I wonder how lubricated my eyes are today? It just does its job. Best commercial I've ever seen on intelligent design was done by Visine. They didn't know they were doing it. But they put out a documentary for kids about the complexity of the human eye and why you should buy Visine. But in the process, what they really did was put out a documentary on how complicated the eye is. Which part of that evolved last? And that's Behe's question. Are there any problems with this argument? The answer, again, is yes, and it's the same problem I mentioned a moment ago. It's a moving target. Okay? So 10 years from now, Somebody else is going to write a science book and say, well, he didn't understand that what really happens to make this work is. Okay. And then someone will write another book, and who'll write another book, and write another book. Okay. So it is a moving target. So that's one problem with making this argument. There's also a problem that's sometimes called the God of the gaps problem. And it happens anytime you invoke science. And Behe has this problem too. So let me give you an idea of how this works. I believe in God because there's stuff in the universe I can't explain. There's gaps in human knowledge. Well, what happens when you learn something? Well, now there's less gap. Well, that's fine. I still believe in God because there's this much in the universe I can't explain. But what if I learn something else? Now there's less. And what happens is the more I learn, if you only believe in God because there are things you don't understand, then the more you understand, the less you believe in God. See the problem? So we have to be careful. We don't want to say, I believe in God because, well, you can't explain this, because tomorrow they might explain that. 2,000 years ago, they didn't know how the sun moved across the sky. I believe in God because Apollo has to drive his chariot across the sky. Well, we figured that one out, right? So you don't say, I believe in God because there's stuff I don't understand. Make sure we say it right. I believe in God because of the stuff I do understand. Because it's incredible. And the more I know about it, the more it's incredible. And that's what Isaac Newton would tell you. I use that sun example for a reason. When Isaac Newton discovered the modern principles of gravity, he didn't say, great, I fixed that, God's not involved anymore. Newton was an enormously religious person. He is the only, I'm full of trivia tonight, he is the only non-member of the Church of England to be buried in Westminster Abbey. Enormously religious. He was a bit of a troublemaker. I think he would have been in the Church of Christ had he been given the chance. He's a little bit of a troublemaker. The English didn't like him religiously. He wrote more about religion than he ever did about science, but nobody remembers any of that. Isaac Newton, when he developed his theory of modern gravitation, he didn't say, look, I found it, I don't need God anymore. He said, look, I found out how God does it. See the difference? He didn't think, well, there's natural stuff, and then there's the stuff God does. He says the Creator sustains the universe. And everything that happens in his universe is something he's doing. So when I find something amazing and complex, I don't say, oh, good, I don't need God for that. I'm supposed to say, look at this. Someone did this, and it's amazing. And that's what Newton said about everything he discovered. His books are frighteningly religious. Remember I said you couldn't get intelligent design into a textbook? You couldn't get Isaac Newton in a textbook today. Because his books are frighteningly religious. Because every time he found something, he said it was God. Okay, so that's basically the idea of the intelligent design movement. Do you want an update, newsflash? The intelligent design movement as a movement trying to get stuff into your kids' textbooks is a dead movement. That it politically ran out of steam. The court system put up roadblocks. It's just not going to happen. They may rebrand it and come up with a new name that's less religious-y, and people will maybe allow that into a textbook someday. But that round of court battles has pretty much all been fought and lost, and come up with something else. But it should tell us something about the modern scientific establishment. I love science, but the modern scientific establishment is adamantly naturalistic. If they cannot put it into a test tube, it does not exist. And God does not fit. And so anything that even has a whiff of divine influence or intelligent design is too much. Fine-tuning is another argument that's kind of fun. It's more in my line of work. I told you I don't do life science, but I just did some life science. But physics, that's where I'm excited. The fine-tuning argument works like this. There are 20 or 30 constants in the universe that make everything work. Okay? They are numbers that are fixed, and they have to be that number no matter what. Charge of an electron, mass of a proton. This is the gravitational constant used in cosmology, used to figure out Big Bang cosmology stuff. They use this number all the time. Okay, they've got to have it. There's 20 or 30 of these numbers that have to be what they are. Now, what do I mean by have to be? Do I mean it's supposed to be 9, but it could really be 10 or 11? Not at all. These numbers are amazingly precise. So, for example, just to wow you with mathematics, the gravitational constant is 6.673 times 10 to the negative 11th meters cubed over kilogram second squared. Be a test at the end of the hour. Hopefully you got all that down. Probably the foremost modern theistic philosopher on this field of study has said, if this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. And that's how precise it is. What is 10 to the 60th? This is just a silly number. You've never seen 10 to the 60th of anything, because this is not a number we use. So let me try to see if I can make sense of it. Okay. Imagine a dial, like on a safe or something, that goes to 0 to 10. Okay. 0 to 1 would be 1 tenth. So if you have to pick 1 and 1 to the 10, or 10 to the 1 power, whatever. Anyway, 1 and 10, you pick one of these things in the dial. Okay. Now subdivide that 1 into 10 more slices. Okay. Now what if I tell you you have to get the right one of those? You've now reached 1 in 10 to the second power, or 1 in 100. Right? If there's now 100 dashes on this dial, you've got to pick one of them. 1 in 100. Okay, so now take one of those dashes. Subdivide it 10 times. You're now 10 to the third. Keep going. I'll come back. When you get to 10 to the 60th subdivisions, that's how finely tuned the dial has to be on the gravitational constant for matter to exist in the universe. And I don't mean life or intelligent life or humans. I mean the periodic table of elements. Anything more complicated than carbon cannot exist unless that number is exactly that number to that degree of accuracy. And there's about 20 or 30 of those numbers that have to be that number. The mathematics on it is just absurd. This isn't even the most precise number. Well, Ben, why don't you give us the best example? Because you wouldn't believe me on the most precise number. The most precise number, I have it written down. I just don't put it on the slide because it's scary. It is 1. The mass and energy of the early universe must be distributed to a precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power. So imagine a 1 with 123 zeros with it. Now take that many zeros and put that behind a 1, and that's the precision of your dial. And there's 20 or 30 numbers like that. Okay. At some point, the mathematics just becomes absurd, right? There's been some interesting books written here in the last 20 years as they've gotten to the cutting edge of physics and started to notice this, about how the universe just shouldn't be here. There is no way you should be able to get 20 or 30 numbers that have to be exactly what they are for the universe to exist, to be calibrated to that degree of accuracy through some random accident. It's absurd on a level that has never been thought about before. One option would be someone much, much smarter than us set all the dials, right, to make this happen. Here's the best part about this argument, and this is why, as a physics guy, I like it. The more you believe in Big Bang cosmology, the more numbers there are. Now, if you believe, like I do, that God can go and there's a universe, I don't have any problems with this. But if you're trying to construct a naturally occurring 13.8 billion year old universe from random chance, you've got to have 20 or 30 of these numbers exactly where they are. And the more you believe that, the more precise the numbers have to be. Okay, so when you start to look at this, again, it kind of gets silly. The numbers defy good sense. Let me give you one more science-y argument, and then we'll be done with science. Next week, no science, everybody. Okay, we'll move on to philosophy. You'll hate that equally as much, but that's okay. The sixth thing I'd point out in this series of arguments is that the universe itself works at all. So we started out with, look at these things in the universe, see how they work, they're designed. Then we said, look at these numbers in the universe, see how precise they are. That's kind of weird. But something else that scientists have started to notice over the last 100 years or so is, why does science work? One of my favorite authors, James, you'll like this, G.K. Chesterton, has a chapter called The Ethics of Elfland, which is a silly title, but all of his titles are silly. He likes that. And he makes this point. He says, when you read a fairy tale and the witch says, go blow your trumpet and the castle will turn into pickles or something like that, you say, well, that's just silly. One thing has nothing to do with the other. He says, because that's magic, right? Okay. He says, have you noticed that the universe isn't like that? We just stopped being surprised by it. Why is it every time I drop something, it falls? Every time. There's never been once where it didn't work. Not only does it always fall, on Earth's surface, it always falls at 9.81 meters per second per second. And it always follows Newton's laws of gravitation. And it always does expect exactly what it's supposed to do. And the more complicated the question, the more precise the answer, and it always works. Why can we use math at all on the universe? Why isn't it one day we drop something and it all just goes up on Tuesdays? Why is it regular? This is what, two names up here, one of them you'll know, one of them you won't maybe. Heisenberg is a developer of some of the ideas of quantum mechanics, and then Einstein, you may know, of course, dealing with relativity. And one time, Heisenberg and Einstein had a conversation, and reportedly, Heisenberg said this. If nature leads us to mathematical forms of great simplicity and beauty, and by forms, I'm referring to coherent systems, hypotheses, axioms, etc., to forms that no one has previously encountered, we cannot help thinking that they are true, that they reveal a genuine feature of nature. You must have felt this too. The almost frightening simplicity and wholeness of the relationships with nature suddenly spreads out before us, and for which none of us was in the least prepared. The guys who were on the cutting edge of 20th century physics said, we were frightened by what we found. Now, Einstein took a different point of view. He wasn't frightened. He says, well, of course, sounds like the way God would make a universe. Einstein, being more or less Jewish, was more very much happy to say, yeah, sure, God's involved in that. But for everybody else, it came as a shock. What's the most famous, you don't have to know physics, what's the most famous equation in all of modern physics? E equals mc squared. I read it on a cartoon when I was a kid, right? It's kind of a joke. It's the only equation we all know. E equals mc squared, sure. Einstein did that. You think how silly that is? That all of the interactions of mass and energy in the entire universe can be boiled down to a couple of letters and written down on a napkin? And that's what he's talking about. This frightening simplicity. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is mind-boggling, but it's easy to write. Give me a couple letters, I can write it down. He says, and that's how I knew it was true. The simpler it was, the more I was sure we were right. Because the universe just kind of makes sense. I have a book in my office by a guy, a physicist named Chandrasekhar from India, and he gave a series of lectures titled On Truth and Beauty. And what the series of lectures is about is an atheist trying to explain to other atheists why the universe is so perfectly mathematical and beautiful. He gets dangerously close to agreeing with us. He just won't do it. He won't do it. But what he talks about is it's just amazing that math works at all, that the universe always works every time. And the more simple our equations, the more we know we're right. And then he'll say something odd like, yeah, I guess the universe is just like that. The Christian says, no, God is just like that. An intelligent creator would do it exactly that way. And that should not surprise us at all. Okay, no more sciencey stuff. Next week we'll talk about morality and other good stuff that we believe in. Okay, thank you.